And they'll be back in a few weeks. But who we have is we have a friend of the wizard, Trip. Trip, you want to say hello?
Hey, everybody.
Well, okay, that's pretty good. That means we know that you are not on that mic. Okay, say hello again.
Hello, hello, okay, hello.
Now we know you're alive and well. Okay. Put those headphones on and you'll know that you're broadcasting and you're getting it. And we are going to talk about some of the things that we started talking about last week. And I think, to be honest with you folks, I mean, this is a new format for Touchstones. You've got a new co-host, Wizard Baldur. And it'll take a little while for our show to, as it were, get its legs. I wasn't really happy with the way the show went last week. But we will eventually find our rhythms, but it'll take a while. So hang in there with us, and maybe in our faux pas and other issues that we have here, we can get a sense of what possibilities are for the new format of Touchstones. Trip, why don't you tell everybody, introduce yourself to people. I know we had you on the show last week, and you hardly had an opportunity to say two words because between me bugging the wizard and the wizard trying to teach his ultimate wisdom, we managed sort of to easily talk over each other. And we'll eventually stop doing that and come to some form of actual communication. So we'll try not to do that today. So why don't you introduce yourself to the listeners?
Well, I'm here because I'm a friend of John's, and he's a friend of yours, and I've spent...
That's the wizard, by the way.
Yeah, I've spent the last 3 years very intensively immersed in, for lack of a better word, spiritual understanding. And John's been a fantastic teacher, and there have been others. Ganeshan, who he introduced me to, is a Indian sage. He's become a friend, and I've been transformed by the teachings of my friends, and my life is truly blessed. And so I guess I'm here because I feel this overwhelming desire to sort of spread the good news, I guess, to other people. I live in Snow Camp, we have a little farm animal sanctuary out there, and I've got a couple small kids that I'm madly in love with, two girls, and I've got a wonderful companion, and I'm building a green co-housing community in Carrboro, which is going to be a state-of-the-art, solar-powered, LEED-certified community. I'm very excited about that.
Okay. Let's go back to the so-called spirituality that you said. So one of the things that you were concerned about, you mentioned to me earlier, was the issue of finding a teacher. What do you think were the important criteria for this?
Well, I do think this aspect of finding an authentic teacher is very important. I look out into the landscape of spiritualism, and I see a lot of individuals that have legions of followers, and often their teachings, I think, are authentic. I think that they definitely have value, and they have a transformative impact on the lives of the people that come to them. However, I personally was not going to be able to surrender myself to a teacher unless they had certain characteristics. And
why would you want to surrender yourself to a teacher anyway? I mean, what's this? What do you mean?
Well, the act of surrendering yourself wholeheartedly to a teacher, I think, is a necessary aspect of coming to abide in a state of spiritual truth, because without that act of surrender, the mind and the ego will continue to question. It won't matter how great the answers you're given. At some point, you have to simply accept that you can never get all of the answers. And unless the person that you're getting your information from really walks the talk and models for you the spiritual truth that you're trying to comprehend and to become, I think it's nearly impossible to get it and to to own it.
Well, you know, Ramana Maharshi said when people came up to him and said, you know, as a master, I'm going to surrender myself to you. He says, no, you're not surrendering yourself to me. You're surrendering yourself to the self.
Well, you know, I used to have a little problem with like gurus where I would see, and this was before I understood it, I would see like the...
Just out of curiosity, what's your context? I mean, you say you're talking about gurus, talking about this, but for our audience and also, what's your context? You're obviously running a tape that you heard some, you know, it's just like you're repeating a song you heard someplace. Where were you hearing it? What were you reading? What were you thinking? What was the milieu that gave you this this view of finding a teacher?
Well, I found my teacher before I actually learned about other teachers, so I was very fortunate in that.
Then what kinds of things were you doing before you found your teacher? Again, what was your context?
Oh, okay. Well, you know, it's interesting. Like many people, I had this feeling, which I couldn't articulate. I didn't really understand the question that I was wanting to ask, which was basically like, what the hell is going on here, and why don't I get it?
Why am I alive, and what does it mean?
Yeah, you know, traditional religion did not satisfy me. There was something...
Did you have any traditional religious background at all?
I did. I was raised an Episcopalian. I was confirmed. My family was not staunchly religious.
You sort of got stuck in Sunday school anyway?
Yeah, I did that.
Yeah.
And religion definitely didn't get it, and we could get into why it didn't, but atheism... which actually, at the deepest level, I subscribe to, but atheism, which was basically, there is no mystery, you know, this is all basically, you know, organic matter floating in space like a dead ball, you know, that didn't get it for me either. And then I read a lot of books, and some of those books were excellent, like Conversations with God and Celestine Prophecy and, you know, all the sort of popular...
Did you hang out anywhere, like at the Unity Church or anything like that?
I did some of that. I went to the Quaker Church. I went to... I did a couple times at the Unity Church, mm-hmm. you know. And still, it wasn't like I was actively seeking. I wasn't really... I hadn't formulated a question in my mind, I'm going to go understand the truth, or I'm going to go become a realized person, or, you know, anything like that. I wasn't sort of formally looking for it.
But, okay, and you're like post-college now, right?
Yeah, this is like between, you know, college and the age of about 47. It's all going on. And so I was interested in that. I was very... taken by Conversations with God. That was the first text that I wrote that really rocked my world. Mm-hmm. And it gave me a kind of different... It opened me up to a possibility that I hadn't been aware of before.
But, right.
Even that ultimately didn't quite get it.
Mm-hmm.
So what happened for me, which I think is what happens for most people, is that there was a major failure in my life. I kind of crashed and burned. And I think mm-hmm. I think it's funny, you know, a lot of people out there would be dismissive or suspicious of a person whose life looked pretty weird or unhappy or, you know, marked by failure. These are the people that we tend to think of as not being the ones we would want to get our advice from. But mm-hmm. in fact, it turns out that the people out there that have crashed and burned, you know, mm-hmm. the most or with the greatest intensity, they're usually the ones that are the best teachers.
Well, you really think so? So you should really be going to, a halfway house for ex-cons then to check out, look for your latest enlightened guy. There is a book, I kind of don't remember who wrote it or the title, in which it was a guy who was, you know, this big cocaine dealer who, you know, ended up in jail and spent a few years in jail. And, you know, and his crash and burn and being in jail was his mark to become enlightened.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, and he claimed that this was his thing, and he talked about what enlightenment was.
Right.
He had a couple of interesting things about enlightenment, which I thought were interesting ideas. Among them was nobody really gives a damn if you're enlightened or not.
No.
Because, you know, so if you think that becoming enlightened means that people will recognize this, you're you know, because most people, if people are interested in enlightenment, which is having some authentic experience of reality, and we will probably get around to talking about what some of that might mean in a while, will wake up to nobody probably cares, you know. And if they do recognize that you have some authentic view of reality, it's probably because they have an inkling of it themselves. And and, you know, there are people floating around like that. Now, when I was younger, and I had a similar orientation since I was a teenager, and I'd meet people who had a taste of authentic reality or some sense of it. I met a number of these people, and the ones I liked the best, I always felt they were not my teachers. They were my colleagues,
mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah.
And that was my view, which, needless to say, which they didn't mind. They didn't mind that at all. And in fact, they found that quite refreshing, because then I would just, you know, I would deal with them, you know, from where I was at and where I thought and what they seemed to be doing, and would talk truth to truth, right?
Yeah.
But I did find that there were other people floating around who saw these people as being really special, you know, and having deep insights into their minds. And I did recognize that on occasion when I would talk to these people about issues that I was going through, yeah, they were helpful in terms of counseling, you know, but ultimately I had to make, you know, the stupid mistakes myself, you know, to figure out what's going on with my life or what isn't going on around with it.
Mm-hmm.
But the... And I did find the devotee style of people, I found it difficult. And I also found that it became something of a straitjacket for some of these so-called collegial friends of mine. And that was always a difference. And I always saw them as they understand what I understand, and their understanding can help my understanding. Now, why is that? Why is it that other people's understanding of authentic non-dual reality, pure consciousness, can help our understanding? Well, the thing is that we all approach it from different levels of illusion. And we don't necessarily shake off the illusion, so we understand it, how both it liberates us and also how that taste of liberation can become another level of bondage, depending upon not just the thinking awareness, but this but beyond thinking into this profound being state. A lot of this is talked about now. We have you know, through the New Age movement and through various teachers, we have people talking about this stuff, and we have people experiencing it now in a way, or experiencing it in ways that were not readily understood 30, 40 years ago, and are better understood now, but only in a superficial sense. For instance, Eckhart Tolle, who is a authentic enough teacher in terms of what he is, what he's got to say. There are things he says that are completely off. You know, I mean, that everything he says isn't the jewel of perfect wisdom, but the point of his main point, which is, you know, to pay attention to the now, is always the first instruction you receive in meditation, traditionally. When I got my first meditation class back in 1968 at the Yoga Academy, that was the first thing they taught us, you know. it's always going to happen now. It's not going to be anything that's going to happen later or something more. This is where you find it. It's in this now, this eternal now. This is what you have to pay attention to. And, I hate to tell people, but Eckhart Tolle did not discover the eternal now. But he did do something smart. He emphasizes it. Because a lot of people talk about meditation, hear about the eternal now, and then run off and immediately forget it and are off seeking various discrete states of mind as if they can be, at like different levels. Does it matter whether you drowned at 3 inches of water or 90 feet of water? I don't know, but perhaps the thing is that we got to drown. Well, let's get back to how does one. So from my point of view of recognizing authentic teacher, what I would say is that I have to go from where I am, where I start. That's why I'm interested in asking you, trying to clarify where you started, where you were.
Well, one aspect of the authentic teacher you just already mentioned is that it's a peer relationship. So if you go to somebody and they hold some kind of position where they make you feel that they are superior to you, or that they are the way through to the truth, they are not an authentic teacher.
Well, the teacher doesn't do that. You know who does that, don't you? The disciples.
Right, okay.
The gatekeepers.
Right.
So, in your particular case, there probably weren't any many gatekeepers around. I don't think...
No,
I don't think the wizard has any gatekeepers. It has too many gatekeepers around, except maybe Carol to keep the riffraff away.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, but the that's his wife, folks.
A second feature of the authentic teacher is that teacher wants absolutely nothing from you. They don't want your affirmation, and they don't want your money. They don't want anything from you. And for me, having two men give something to me where clearly they had nothing they wanted in return, that is often a singular experience at the hands of a realized person. It's very rare in life when you get something from someone else absolutely unconditionally where they don't even expect or want to thank you. I think we all need that to perceive the truth of ourselves.
Well, let's talk a little bit more about that. One thing is that we live in a world of reciprocities. You know, I scratch your back, you scratch mine, and some people think that's love.
Right.
You know, and that definitely is the way we sort of lubricate our way through life. You know, it's definitely the nature of business. Let me do a little business your way. You throw a little business my way. Let me pay you a little money, and you will do this service for me.
Right.
All of which are very conditional. And conditionality here is, is one of the ways of the world. It's relative. And what the nature of this awareness is, or this consciousness that you're speaking of, is not that.
Exactly.
So
you're talking about the fallacy of the notion of the good deed doer, okay? I think that our culture has ingrained in all of us, and it comes from our puritanical roots, the idea that we are worth something, we have a certain value to society, to ourselves, to others, to the degree that we are good and do good works for others. And the problem with that proposition is that sort of the seeds of its own destruction are built inside of it, because once you take the proposition that you are the doer of the good deed, you have now basically, you are now living in your ego as the one doing the deed, rather than seeing yourself as an instrument of divine grace.
Wait a minute. Let's slow down here a little bit with this good deed thing here.
Right.
Well, there's more than involved in, now. Good deed is one version of this, but let's broaden the palette, because I think your anecdote is for all of them. There's also the person who's the bad deed doer.
Sure.
you know, I mean, there in every family, usually there's the black sheep and, you know, or the person who's, you know, the garbage dump for the rest of the family, you know, and they're the ones who can do no good or can never do good enough. You know, no matter what their achievements are, they're always less than par. They're the ones that aren't given the rewards. They don't win the lottery. They aren't the prettiest people in the thing and so forth and so on. You know, they're not the heroes that people look up to. So, yes, so one level we have this, I can be a hero and I can be special. And the way I am special is through what I do or how I look and or how much money I can make or how powerful I am or how manipulative I can be. I mean, there's a whole variety of strategies that we learn at great length and with great depth this is pretty much who we think we are, you know, this behavioral manipulative doing core, you know, and the way that we define ourselves in the world is through our activity, our achievements, you know, by, you know, this is how we're defined. And this is how we, measure. We, you know, if we become an artist, we do so by our creation of art. Now, the art for us is a process, but we're also going to be measured by our product. And our product is going to, and it's also to the degree that it's admired by others. So there's a whole variety of levels here. All of this deed doing, and it's not just good deed doing. See?
Any doing.
Yeah, it's any kinds of doing. And that's because there is this particular version of what's called the do-gooder, and those are people who think that in order to be truly holy, to be truly doing, that they need to help other people. And there is a place where that's important. But the place where that's important is not in the achievement of the good, it's rather in the process.
But there is a basic human desire to be good, to be loved, to be thought of as a contributing member of the society that you're in and what have you. And one of the hang-ups that people who are drawn to the spiritual truth that we're talking about but can't quite get there or embrace is they can't quite, like, understand how there can be no good and ultimately no good or evil in the world. I know myself that for years I would not investigate further this truth because I stopped right there. I said, if you're going to tell me that the world is not ultimately a place of morality where there's good and evil, I'm not really interested in hearing your teaching. And then I would construct these hypothetical situations in my mind about my kid being, you know, abducted and, you know, tortured or
right,
whatever.
That's
okay.
The classic ones. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I couldn't get over that hang up. Since I couldn't get over that hang up, I'm guessing a lot of people can't get over that hang up. And what people don't get
right.
is that when you give up the sense of doership, and you become an instrument of divine will rather than a doer, whatever, of good deeds, bad deeds, or what have
you. Wait. You're jumping too fast, too far.
All right. Well,
instrument of divine will stuff. Let's slow down. Let's explore what you just said a little more. I know this is probably a little irksome for you, but you know, because you see, I think you're taking too many leaps with your language, and I want you to be more careful with it. Okay, so let's look at this this issue of good and evil. Yeah, there is a morality in which there's good and evil. I mean, you know, there's definitely a level. It's just the same sort of reciprocity level we were just talking about. However, they're theologically stated. If you look deeply into the religions, you'll find that there is a good beyond good and evil. There, you know, and there is a good that doesn't need evil to justify it. In fact, there's a good that doesn't cast a shadow. And so there is a possibility of something that is not in this reciprocal realm. And what that is closer to what I think you're talking about when you jump to, this idea of divine grace. So let's continue with this idea of there not being a doer.
Okay. Well, I'll go back to address both that point and to finish up on the point of the authentic teacher, okay, because they're one and the same. The final aspect of an authentic teacher is that essentially there's nobody home, okay? It's like a headless person who has ceased to identify with their storyline, ceased to identify with this horizontal paradigm of a birth, life, death, of a material world. They don't identify with that anymore. And when you look at a person like that for the very first time, when you sit in the room with someone like that, and it didn't happen to me until I was 43 years old, so you can go through your entire life without...
Yeah, actually, I just thought this guy was 22, see? So.
Okay.
So I can tell how old people are.
God's been right. Kind on the gene pool.
Uh-huh.
So when you sit in the room for the first time with someone who is what I would call gone. They're not identified with themselves as a person, as a storyline. Rather, that is dissolved away, and they see themselves as divine grace itself, as an extension of divine will, so that they don't see themselves as the doer. When you sit in the room...
Wait. I'm not interested in words like divine grace. I mean, you know, that is not a word that readily resonates with my experience. I mean, I can make it resonate with my experience, but I'm assuming someone in the audience in which that's an alien term. It doesn't mean anything. Those are just words. You know, those are mumble words that mean nothing.
Oh, okay.
So.
All right, well, let's talk about this.
So let's.
Let's talk about this.
If you want to talk about this authentic thing, define divine grace? What I want you to do is not define divine grace. I want you to talk about it in terms that are accessible.
Now, right.
You felt this stuff accessibly.
Okay.
And you later learned to call it something like divine grace. Yep. Well, tell us the accessible experience of it.
All right. Well, rather than put a label on it, which can't be done, I can only point to it. Never fully grasp it or own it. Okay, I can't do that. But I will submit that everyone can come to a feeling for that when they ponder the infinite number of things that happen in their own body every moment to simply be alive. Okay, there are an infinite number of autonomous digestive actions, circulation actions, assimilation of oxygen in the body. Okay, do any of us have anything to do with any of that? No.
You mean in terms of our conscious will?
Yeah.
Our ego?
Yeah.
Well, I choose to... Actually, you know Schopenhauer? I love to tell this story. Schopenhauer, you know, the philosopher, you know, the world is will and representation.
Yeah.
Schopenhauer, something of a...
I don't know it, actually, but go
but,
ahead.
Yeah, okay. Well, you know, it's definitely a good read, worthy read. You know, he's a great romantic philosopher, sort of took on Hegel and showed where he was all wrong. And it was a wonderful philosopher. By the way, nobody paid any attention to this guy. Uh-huh. They just thought he was a kook. He never got a good university position. Nobody paid attention to his writings until he was an old man. And then they finally paid attention to him with the last year or two of his life. And by then he was just this old curmudgeon, you know. But one of the things that happened with him was that he used to carry around with him the Upanishads, the German edition of the Upanishads, and he would read them, and he considered this stuff really important and potent teachings. And, you know, in there he, of course, had read about pranayama, and, you know, so he what he did is he went and did his pranayama exercises of, you know, breathing in and breathing out. And what happened is he did this with great intensity. And somehow, of course, you have to remember that this is the guy who wrote the book, The World as Will and Representation, said, you know, and representation is another word for the dream, by the way. Is that he suspended the autonomic nervous system. So when he stopped thinking about willfully doing his breathing, he stopped breathing. And, you know, so he had to consciously continue breathing. And apparently it went for almost 2 days where he couldn't sleep because every time he stopped breathing, he couldn't breathe. Mm. and it freaked him out terribly. You know, unless it never were. He never messed around with Pranayama again. But now this guy, you know, in terms of, you know, being a control freak, was way over the top as far as control freakery goes. But the...
You
know...
So the pre-existing, you could call it intelligence, you could call it awareness, but that pre-existing and ever-present awareness that makes possible these infinite number of operations within our bodies, and then which has brought to fruition you and I here and now in this breathable atmosphere on a stable planet that is from the stuff of stars, that grace, that's what I'm calling divine grace.
Well, okay, let's slow down here a little bit. Why don't we, instead of calling it grace, let's talk about something that we all have an experience of now. Let's say it's our basic awareness.
Okay.
Now, it's just our awareness. It's not what we're aware of. Almost.
It's not our awareness.
Okay, we can say that. But most of us, most people think it's theirs, you know, because it, you know, they think that this awareness is inside their body.
Well, there you now. There's a whole nother fallacy that you know.
We can talk about that. But let's talk about awareness now.
Okay.
All right. So you're aware, and I'm aware, and what I'm aware of ain't necessarily what you're aware of, but there is this quality of sensitivity that we have going there. It's part of it's sense related, you know, I hear, speak, smell, taste, touch. But there's also a sense of it, a integrative sense of it that seems to be inside all of those things, that integrates those perceptions, those sensate perceptions into a kind of feel think.
John would say, the wizard would say, it's the string on which all these other pearls are hung. It's the underlying sixth sense.
And the pearls would be?
Well, these other senses of sight and of thinking or whatever, of cognition, I don't, you know, touch, taste, they all hang on an underlying awareness that makes them all possible.
And it holds them together in a way.
Holds it all together.
Holds it together. Okay. All right. Now, that's something that one can sense, you know. I mean, you don't have to. This is not something that imaginatively you have to throw away. It may be that you don't necessarily think that this is particular. It's a subtle sense. This perception. This kind of awareness. It's subtle, but you may not think that this giving it this particular importance. So what we're going to do now is we're going to examine it. We're going to look at it in greater depth. We're going to open ourselves up to it.
Well, you know, I don't think that we can ever really talk about it or own it or define it, but finishing up on the authentic teacher, when you're sitting in their presence and they're not...
No, what makes their presence unique?
Well, I'll tell you, see, it's a thing that you can't explain to someone else until you're in the room with that person, all right? But when you're in that room with that person who is an authentic teacher... authentic, realized person, because they're not grinding away on their ego, because they don't have a sense of, a small sense of personal identification with their storyline, because they're like an open window.
Okay.
Mirror. They mirror back to you.
Okay. Let's relate some of this stuff to this little thread that we were talking about.
Okay.
So what I want you to do is I want you to tie in this innate awareness that you have of how it all holds together for you.
Yeah.
Now, even though for you is making it egotistical, we know this at this point. The idea ultimately is to realize that this awareness is almost antithetical, but not in opposition to the ego. See, this is the interesting thing about awareness, is it doesn't oppose the ego. The ego very much claims it for its own and says, this is who I am, right? You know, this subtle, simple awareness that we all have, this capacity, it's sort of a innate capacity, though to be honest with you, probably can't just begin to distinguish it from the inchoate mishmash of feelings and desires that are in somebody for takes a while and some facility to be able to distinguish it from a mishmash of everything else that goes on in ourselves at different levels, different pools and pools. Because this thing, another quality of this string is that it's very peaceful, profoundly peaceful. Now, this is something that's inside yourself. Now, when you say you see another teacher,
not another teacher, but when
when you see an authentic teacher, you're saying is that you hear their silence or their serenity.
They bring a kind of silence into the room, a spaciousness that you've never experienced before.
And this is the way you experienced
it. Yeah, this is the way I experienced it, where you go, oh my God, that is what is actually ever present, and that is me, and I can be that too. I can be that at peace inside myself.
So you recognized in someone else.
Yeah.
Okay.
Myself.
You recognized this deeper part of yourself.
Exactly.
As a potential that before then was sort of semi-hid.
It was hidden.
For you, it felt like it was hidden.
It was hidden, yep.
Yeah. And then all of a sudden you see someone else and they show you. This is actually, I've heard a lot of people describe it that way, but it's interesting to as we're belaboring the point here.
And you know what?
Yeah.
I had a meltdown. I mean, tears poured down my face.
Mm-hmm.
It was the greatest relief I'd ever felt in my life.
You suddenly felt that you didn't have to measure up anymore.
Exactly.
Huh?
Exactly. It was absolute liberation. I realized I already am eternal life. I don't have to die and get there. I don't have to do anything good.
I don't have to
learn anything, change mm-hmm. anything, study anything, worship anybody, anything.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
What a freaking relief.
Mm-hmm.
What a relief.
That was pleasant. Yeah. So what's all this? What's all this effort here about? You know, divine grace, and one can never know what it is. It sounds like you had a pretty good experience of it that way.
You can have the direct
experience. Did you have the old moonrise of the ego? Pipped over there, the horizon and said, "Well, you may think everything is one, but I'm going to divide it up for you."
There's a distinction. You can never know what it is, but you can directly experience it. And that experience can stay with you. And in fact, it has stayed with me. And
well, of course, there are people who say that the knowing itself is the experience, so that it's not that you can't know what it is. It's direct knowing. It's non-dual knowing, sometimes called gnosis, though that's a special term of gnosis.
I say the teachers, the teachings and the teachers are very clear that words are symbols. The word water is not wet. John likes to use that all the time. Yeah, we all know that words can't really get it. They don't really get it. But in the hands of a very gifted person who has a fantastic way of articulating themselves, who has also experienced the truth, the words can bring you right to the edge. And they can create this kind of milieu, this kind of, they can take you and transport you into a place where you are then able to relax enough to let go of the thought.
Yeah, this is true enough, and it's an interesting paradox though language itself could be said to be naturally dualistic in that words themselves will never be wet. You can use language, or language can be used to express a non-dual truths. You know, this, for instance, making the distinction between the direct, unmediated, and non-representational immediacy of gnosis versus, let's say, cognition. Cognition is being aware of something, whereas gnosis is awareness, where the of is subordinate and within the field of awareness. The awareness is Often what we do with being aware of something is that we are setting ourselves into a relative relationship with to the of.
So here's another thing that just came up for me while I was listening to you about being aware of something and then having the direct experience is that one of the blocks, if you will, of the Gen Pop in sort of not only intellectually getting this, which many people do now, there are millions of people, but actually having this sense of having the direct experience of it is that it is so simple and it is so undramatic, if you will, that mm-hmm. people can't believe that is Christ consciousness, you know, that is it. And the human being is unwilling to acknowledge it. They're unwilling to say, I am that, okay?
Yeah, yeah.
And it is like beyond most people to accept the simplicity of the experience, even when it presents it to them, even when they experience it. They easily go back into the dream because it's so simple. How can it be this simple? But it is. And that's one of the paradoxes.
Yeah, I agree. The there's a story in Yoga Vashishta in which I'm trying to make sure I locate it here. I think this is where it is. Let's see, is that it? No. No, that's not it. Well, I'm not going to find it right now. But I'll paraphrase the story because it's the first story. Yoga Vashishta is a teaching book that's sort of like the Vedanta, but it's a little different. One of the first stories that's told in it is about a son of a great teacher who, is, you know, taught by his father, you know, what the ultimate nature of reality is. And he talks to his friends, and his friends say, well, that's nothing. It's got to be more than that if it's all so big and different. So his father brings in another sage, and the sage sits down with the kid and says, okay, and this is what it is. He says, well, my father's already told me that. You know, and he says, well, you know, do this kind of meditation. He says, I did that meditation. I know this thing. I know what this is. You know, so the guy says, well, that's it. Now, there is going to the degree you and my telling you that is what you need to hear now. That's it. Don't look for it any other place, because what will happen and does happen is this is what his friends were doing. Is you're going to have people saying it can't be just that.
Right.
It's too simple.
Exactly, and that's the surrendering to the teacher part. And one of the
it's not the surrendering to the teacher part. What it is, it's the surrendering to the authentic experience of the self.
Of your own experience.
Of your own basic experience of who you are.
Believe
that's
it.
Not surrendering to a teacher unless that teacher is yourself.
That's fine.
But...
one other thing I want to say about teachers to wrap up.
The point for the teacher here is very secondary. The point of the teacher, it's important but secondary. The importance of the teacher is not to, is to help you to confirm, the key point. The key point is that is this non-dual awareness within yourself. However you initially experience it, the key point of the teacher is to confirm, yes, that's it, mm-hmm. and to confirm that. The point of the teacher is not to confer that authenticity.
No, they can't confer it. One thing I want to say about the whole teacher thing, though, which is another big illusion out there in the world, is that And this is an illusion that I harbored until fairly recently, within the last couple of years, which is this. You have this idea that these great teachers are rare as hen's teeth, okay? You hear of Jesus Christ, and you hear of Buddha, and maybe you hear of a few others, right?
Yeah, that's right. And they're so rare, they found religions around them.
Right, right. And so you have this idea that, wow, this thing of whatever it is, realization, living in Christ consciousness, or whatever you want to slap a label on it, which would indicate that, you know, you've arrived in a space of deep inner peace and awareness, okay? That's so rare that only Jesus Christ and Buddha, you know, only these singular individuals that happened once every 3,000 years are actually abiding in that. Actually, no. There are quite a few people walking around that are living in the truth. And we know what's really rare as hen's teeth is the individual, the devotee, the student or whatever, who is ripe enough to be ready.
To recognize.
Those are the ones who are rare as hen's teeth. And when you are that ripe and you are that on fire, when you're like a man whose head's being held underwater trying to get air because you want it that bad, teachers come out of the woodwork. They're everywhere, okay? And they can't wait to spend one-on-one time with you because you are the rarity, okay? You are the rarity, not the teacher. When you are that ripe.
Well, but we have to also recognize this. What I was going on a little bit was before is that there are these things. There are disciples floating around. Like, you know, when I was looking for teachers, I always saw them as collegially and in a collegial fashion, that they were colleagues, that they understood what I was seeking to understand. And that they could help. They could, and usually what they did is they confirmed my knowledge to a degree. You know, sometimes they also confirmed where I was going off to, you know, fantasy land. But you know, so everybody's has their own way of doing this, their own taste and touch of it.
And one other thing, a shaker of salt or a piece of dirt can be your teacher if you stay present with that. With an intense level of presence and focus, anything in which you are completely.
What I want to talk about you know, it isn't the authentic versus inauthentic teacher, though I've definitely seen both floating around in a variety of ways, but it's also the inauthentic disciple. And the inauthentic disciple is the disciple who wants to give themselves up and over to the other. Actually, it's in Sufi paths, and I mean in a variety of mystical paths, this is an allowable crutch. In other words, they allow this to happen. Psychologically, it's called transference is what it's called, you know, in psychoanalysis and psychotherapy. But what it is the person gives themselves up. They say, you have a sense of what's authentic and I don't, therefore I worship you. But, you know, the thing that is completely missing from that is the deepest recognition of the uniqueness and the oneness, mm-hmm. you know.
Yeah.
What I've discovered is that as one friend of mine once said, is that, you know, wherever there's a great light, there are a lot of bugs. I think that what it is that, you know, if somebody is naturally shining their own beingness. And for some reason, this is somehow broadcast, not by radio folks. Remember, we're saying the highest teaching is silence, and here I am talking about it constantly.
Yeah, well, I don't know who it was. It was Muktananda or one of these great sages that John spent a lot of time with, and I think it was one of the initial visits. I don't remember which one, but there was this huge God squad around him. It might have been Muktananda.
Yeah, a lot of them have.
Yeah, but no, this guy was the real deal. And he pulled John aside and his companion aside, whoever it was, I don't remember, it might have been Philip Rigo or whatever, and he said, you know, these guys around me right here, they're the ones that need it the most.
They're the ones that understand it the least.
Exactly. These are the guys that need it the most. So, you know, that's...
The thing is that teachers are often imprisoned by their... by their disciples. It does happen, and I've definitely seen it. Of course, one of the other issues that came up and was a big deal conventionally back in the 70s was the degree in which teachers, because of this abandonment, were, you know, often found themselves caught up in sexual or various other scandals, because, you know, you're seen as the embodiment of this incredible wisdom. So not only will they take your authentic statements, but they'll take all the claptrap and silliness that you haven't worked through yet.
Well, that's a whole nother authentic. Yeah, we could talk a long time about that whole thing. But one other thing that I want to say about teachers is that, and my ego would like to take credit for this, but the degree to which you make your own the experience of an authentic teacher allows you to really have a accelerated learning curve. So, for example, John the Wizard had 30 years of intense spiritual materialism where he went out and Muktananda took him on, you know, cosmic journeys through the universe and whatnot. And see, since he did all that and came out the other side and reported to me that, like, that ain't it, I don't need to do all that. And so if you're able to make that leap of faith that your teacher's teachings are authentic, you can own their entire experience, and then you can take off from that point rather than having to make all those... Well, they're not mistakes, but have all those experiences yourself.
And so, the big ecstasies, the visionary experiences that some people like to talk about, some people think are important or even germane to the spiritual path, are not germane to the spiritual path. What is germane to the spiritual path, again, is sort of like what old Eckhart Tolle talks about. You know, it almost sounds like I'm a disciple of his. But to be honest with you, when I first discovered his work was in a review that was in the Ramana Maharshi newsletter, and they were one of the first people to review his Power of Now, and they talked about meeting of how he understood this profound, simple dedication to now. If you are in the now, then you are also, you're the self is present to you, because the self is now, is not never anywhere else but now, and is never any but present. So as you engage quietly and settle in, the other thing is, you know that you're paying attention to the now. When the sense of restlessness that you may feel, the restive meaning of wanting to move and be here, be there, is sort of falls away, and there's a simple contentment with whatever is here. And there's also not an interest necessarily in the phenomenon. You know, you're not interested in thinking or entertaining yourself with ideas or stories or any of these other things, just this profound sense of being here now. The other thing that's natural about this now awareness is that it, besides being peaceful, and again, this is classic, is it's blissful. Bliss is a kind of happiness which doesn't have any hangers or hooks on it. It doesn't hook you into, well, this has to be what it is. You know, she has to be present. I have to adore her face. She's the one who's special to me, or he is the one who's special to me.
Yep.
This is some of the ways that we misplace our own awareness is in some of these kinds of experiences that are natural to have. But also, but in some ways, if one balances these natural longings and for to live in the world and be in the world with a contemplative sense, you can have a little bit. You can have both. It's sort of like having your cake and eating it too, in the sense that the unconditional truth and love is present. And, you know, and that's basically what everybody wants anyway, even though it isn't necessarily what we think it is. Well, that's another edition of Touchstones. By the way, you're listening to WCOM LP, Chapel Hill in Carrboro. It's 103.5. It's your community radio station, FM. You can also hear us occasionally, though not today, on internet, where we're available at communityradio.coop. And we also have podcasts, and if you check communityradio.com, check for Touchstones, you will find the URL that'll take you to where we hide away podcasts of this show, and you can listen in when at your convenience as an MP3. Well, I really hope to have you here. Enjoying a trip to continue our discussion next week. I don't know if he's got the time.
Yeah, and I can come back next week.
And he's asking, he's our factotum for the Mr. Wizard Baldur. So on that note, I want to thank you for being here, and I am going to return you to our regular programming. So long. This is Reverend Paul.